Throughout the summer, the series has been finding texts in the Bible that encourage us to think about issues of social justice. And so I went with the story of Ruth today. Phyllis Trible wrote in her book, God and the Rhetoric of Sexuality, regarding the biblical book of Ruth, that it takes, quote, ears to hear the stories of women in a man's world. Jesus used that phrase often. Those who have ears, let them hear. Two people can hear the same story, but those who have ears can hear a deeper meaning. Those who have ears can hear what's not being said as well as what's being said. Those who have ears have perspective that others, because of their privilege and circumstance, may lack. I volunteer at Portland's community radio station, KBOO. Everybody should do some volunteering, and that's my thing. I hang out there. I like to do it. I try to help out that radio station. It has a mission. And I produce my podcast there, and now and then they'll air it if the particular show isn't too religious. If you haven't visited that station on Southeast Burnside and 8th, you ought to go take a tour sometime. It's really an interesting place, and they'll be happy to show you around. It's volunteer-based. There are staff, but the programming, for the most part, is done by volunteers. In fact, you could be a volunteer. You could learn, get involved, learn radio. The station, like I said, has a mission. It runs on donations, takes no corporate money, and here's its vision statement. KBOO fearlessly strives to deliver powerfully just, lovingly eclectic, vibrantly provocative, grassroots content while honoring our growing radical revolutionary legacy. There is a poet involved in this, don't you think? KBOO commits to providing an inclusive, empowering atmosphere to decolonize mass consciousness with humility and integrity, making a lasting and evolving impact on our communities. KBOO embraces a creative climate that emphasizes fun, truth, beauty, joy, peace, love, and justice. Sounds like a fun church. All programmers are required to attend an orientation, which I did a few weeks ago. I learned about Portland's and KBOO's history. History, as we know, is not just history, purely objective. History is interpretation and perspective. The storytellers of the history shape the history. And those with privilege have written most of the history books. The Bible was ultimately constructed by those with privilege. And so we talked a lot about privilege at this meeting. There's a truism regarding privilege. If you don't see it, you have it. Privilege means that one's condition conveys status, which is access to power and agency. Irrespective of personal attributes, skills, or even beliefs about oneself, privilege automatically opens doors and shuts others. Privilege constructs glass ceilings. It looks clear, looks like it can get there, but boom, you run into a ceiling. Nobody built the ceiling. Nobody individually is responsible. No one builds the edifice of privilege, and yet it's there, nonetheless. Sometimes it's written into law. Mostly, though, it's reflected in unwritten and in unspoken ways in which we behave, if we know how to get along. Privilege is often unconscious to those who have it, and it doesn't always have to remain that way, but it is very conscious to those who do not have it. So during one of the exercises, we examined 12 different categories of privilege. 12 is just, I guess, a magic number. There are many more. But for each category in which we were privileged, we added an orange dot to our name tag. And for each category in which we were not of the privileged status, we added a green tag. And I don't know if you remember all of them, but here are a few of them. Male, check. Orange dot. I think that's pretty clear cut. If any of you guys don't have ears to hear how being male results in privilege, I'm sure there are other human beings in the room who could count the ways. White, again, check. Orange dot. Persons of color receive a green dot. This is the case of privilege often unconscious to many who are white, because often there is a lack of interaction between white folks and people of color. If you are middle class and higher, you got an orange dot. And a rule of thumb that they offered for deciding what class you are in is this: if you pay less than half your income on rent, you are privileged. Heterosexuals, orange dot. Lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender individuals, a green dot. Again, pretty obvious. If you're a Christian in our culture, you get an orange dot. Anything else, including other faith traditions or none, is not a privileged status. Finally, I got a green dot. If you are between the ages of 25 and 45, you get an orange dot. You're privileged outside. Hey, I finally was happy. Got a green dot. If English is your first language, orange dot. If you were born in the United States, orange dot. If your body type is close to the ideal, you get an orange dot. There's another green for me. And how they determine that is if you wear clothing that doesn't have extra in the label. You're an orange dot. If you have a disability, you get a green dot. Those without disabilities have privilege. And those are just some. At the end of the exercise, my name tag was mostly orange. I'm privileged in almost every category we can name. And all that means is that I have the luxury to go through life and not have to think about it. That is, I don't have to think about it for my survival. Those who are not privileged do not have that luxury. Now, I certainly wasn't the only one in the group. There are others with a lot of orange dots like me, and there are some with plenty of green dots too. But what happens in these sorts of exercises is that those with a lot of privilege tend to be defensive or take it personally or feel guilty or otherwise put out. And they have to be reminded that privilege does not mean fault. They also need reminding that feeling bad isn't helpful. Say it, get it out, get over it. In fact, those with privilege, as they develop ears to hear, that is, as they develop consciousness about privilege and about their own privilege, can offer important contributions to the beloved community, as Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. phrased it. If your privilege has given us access, or if our privilege has given us access to a level of influence and power, then that influence and power can be used to help raise consciousness about privilege. And that influence and power can provide a vehicle for another's voice and ultimately be used to change laws and structures and attitudes. Now, there's complexity, of course, to all of this. We may be privileged in some areas, not in others. We're always needing to become more aware, more conscious of the way privilege serves to elevate some and to marginalize others. One advantage to not having privilege, and you know it if you have it, is in any of these categories you have a green dot, because the lack of privilege, and you know it, you do not have to, you know you don't have privilege. Let me start that all over. The advantage to not having privilege is that you have a perspective, and you know it well. For example, if you have a disability, you don't have to learn about the privilege associated with being able-bodied. You know it. You already have ears to hear, so to speak. You have perspective. So when we know about various aspects of life in which we are privileged and those in which we are not, we can better gauge when we need to listen and when we should speak. If we are privileged in certain ways, we need to do more listening to those who have the advantage of perspective, the disadvantage of not having privilege. If we have perspective because of our lack of privilege, then that perspective needs to be heard. So back to the question. What does it mean, those who have ears? It means that those who have perspective have ears to hear within a story or within a history account or a news event or a community gathering or a civic meeting, how what is being said or not being said bolsters up the already powerful and privileged. To use an illustration from KBOO, KBOO recently constructed another production studio. They had a donation from somebody, and it's a nice studio, and it's needed as more people are getting involved in making audio there. But there's a problem, and it wasn't known until after the fact. It has a problem even that this highly conscious group didn't recognize in time. It would have been recognized had someone with this perspective been on the planning team for its construction. The door to the studio is too narrow to allow access for a wheelchair. So when the old room was remodeled for the studio, the door wasn't widened. There was no ill intent. No one decided to consciously keep people with wheelchairs out of the studio. No one thought about it. We weren't conscious about our ableist privilege. If you don't see privilege, you got it. The lesson that's always needing to be learned is to gather diverse perspectives as we engage in decision-making that affects everyone. So what does this have to do with the book of Ruth? Well, the book of Ruth is a short story, and it is a story jammed in the middle of a patriarchal Bible. And in the story, the women have agency. Here's the plot. There's a man named Elimelech and his wife Naomi leave Judea to the land of Moab because of economic circumstances. And they have two sons, Mahlon and Chilion. The two sons marry, and the wives of the two sons are Ruth and Orpah. Ruth and Orpah are Moabites. Okay, so the Judeans go into Moab, and the two sons marry these Moabites. Some time passes, Elimelech dies. And then, tragically, both sons die. So Naomi, the Jew, and Orpah and Ruth, the Moabite, make up this family. Naomi realizes that she needs to go back to her homeland in order to survive. She has kin there. She needs to do what she needs to do. In a patriarchal culture, it's dangerous for women to be alone out of their own country. Her daughters-in-law want to go with her, but she tells them to stay, find husbands, because their kin ultimately would be there. Orpah agrees. She has agency, and she decides to use it, and she stays in Moab. Ruth, however, clings to Naomi and says what we might hear at weddings. Wherever you go, I shall go. Wherever you live, I shall live. Your people will be my people. Your God will be my God. Where you die, I shall die, and there I shall be buried. I don't necessarily tell people that they've just married their mother-in-law when they say that, but so Naomi and Ruth return to Bethlehem, Naomi's ancestral home. And the women of the city greet Naomi. Oh, we're so glad to have you back. And Naomi says, don't call me Naomi. Call me Mara, which means bitter, because Yahweh has treated me bitterly. We learn that Naomi has a relative, a fairly rich one. Name is Boaz. And by coincidence, or is it divine providence, Ruth goes out to glean in a field, and the field just happens to be Boaz's field. And he notices her, and he speaks with her, and he promises her that she can glean, and she won't be harassed. She can gather the grain from the edge of the field. In fact, then he goes and tells his people to let her go in the middle, too, get some good stuff. Ruth tells Naomi what happened and tells him that the man's name is Boaz, and Naomi is delighted, blessing Yahweh, with change in fortune. Ruth continues to glean with the women of Boaz and live with her mother-in-law. Some time passes, and Naomi comes up with a scheme. Because it's winnowing time on the threshing floor, Ruth will have a chance to seduce Boaz. And Naomi tells Ruth that after Boaz has had enough food and drink and fades off to sleep, she should sneak in and uncover his feet and lie down. Uncover his feet is a euphemism. Enough said. We're keeping it all PG. Boaz wakes up in the middle of the night, and there's this woman. So after they exchange some pleasantries, Ruth comes out with what she wants. As the male nearest of kin, Boaz, she suggests subtly, is obligated to take Ruth as his wife. So it all looks good. Boaz is impressed that Ruth chose him rather than a younger man, and he also had kind of an eye for her, as we saw earlier. But there is a plot twist. There's another man closer in kin to Naomi than Boaz is. And this guy gets first shot. And so Boaz says he's going to let him know. But if the other guy wants Ruth, great, you've got a husband. But if not, then I will marry you. So Boaz meets with the men of the city at the city gate. And 10 guys he gathers around, and the relative just happens to walk by. And so Boaz addresses him and has him sit down. And among a number of witnesses, he says that Naomi wants to sell her field. This is now Elimelech's field. So we learn that she had some property. Apparently she has her husband's property. And the relative can buy it if he wants. So he says, okay. And then he says the other part. The twist is that Ruth comes with the deal. And of course, any children would belong to Elimelech's house. In other words, the guy wouldn't get the inheritance. Well, this is all too complicated for the relative. And so he declines. And so then Boaz marries Ruth. This is a man's world, right? Men own the property, which include the women. The men are making these deals outside the gate with other guys. They make their statements to the Lord after this, who has blessed Boaz and all of his male ancestors and all of the male descendants who will come after him. The Lord's made a name for Boaz, the men sing. But we know something's up, because the actors of the story are really the women. Ruth and Naomi, and divine providence working through them. Ruth has his son with Boaz, and she presents him to Naomi as her grandchild. Now, for the men at the gate, he's the offspring of Elimelech, son of Boaz. But the other women of Bethlehem do not speak of it this way. It's kind of similar to a Greek chorus. The women start to sing. That's when you get the meaning of the story. And this is what the story really means for those who have ears to hear. The women say to Naomi, "Blessed be the Lord, who has not left you this day without next of kin, and may his name be renowned in Israel." That's the Lord's name. "The Lord shall be to you a restorer of life and a nourisher of your old age. For your daughter-in-law who loves you, who is more to you than 7 sons, has borne him." And then the women name the child Obed. And the narrator tells us that Obed's the father of Jesse, who is the father of David, King David. So the story of Ruth and Naomi is a story of survival in the midst of patriarchy. We have a person without privilege on a couple of crucial levels, a woman and a foreigner in Ruth's case, who's also a widow. Naomi, who's lost a husband and 2 sons, faces despair. How are they going to make it? How might we hear this story? I'm just going to mention a few complications and not elaborate. We have a storyteller. Someone wrote the story, anonymous. Who was it? What is this person's perspective? Is this a woman's story or a man's story? How did the story get in the Bible anyway? And why? How did it slip by the patriarchal canonization process? What made it male enough to pass? Perhaps all that guy talk at the gate helped. The conclusion of the story details the ancestry of Boaz, all male, and all of his offsprings male down to David. Maybe that's how it got in. Patriarchy made it about Boaz. But those with ears to hear, with perspective, hear that the agents are Ruth and Naomi. It's their story. And yet, even it can't be told without the patriarchal framing. And then there's another perspective. Here we are, inheritors of this story and a long interpretive tradition. Influenced by our patriarchal traditions through a long line of privileged male teachers and preachers like me. I'll tell you what it means. So how should the story be interpreted? How should it not be interpreted? And then, of course, there's Yahweh. Yahweh never acts or speaks. People speak about Yahweh. Naomi and Ruth and Boaz, the men at the gate, and the women of Bethlehem. They all talk about God doing this and that. But we only know what God does, if God does anything, through those who talk about God. So who do we trust to speak about God? Is it the men at the gate who refer to Ruth as simply the woman and make it all about God blessing Boaz and his house? Patriarchy now, patriarchy tomorrow, patriarchy forever. Thank you. Or do we trust the women of Bethlehem who tell Naomi that the Lord has blessed her and has restored her life and that her daughter-in-law is more to her than seven sons? Seven sons, a symbol of patriarchy if there ever was one. I just throw all that out there, and I want to say that the Bible's a complicated book. It empowers and it disempowers. It's a book of privilege, and a book, when heard with ears that hear, challenges even its own patriarchy at times. Naomi's story and Ruth's story are in the Bible, and they are not model women, as seen by patriarchy's model of model women, even though we used to hear sermon after sermon when I was a kid about how Ruth was the model woman. She was patriarchalized even more. Naomi's story and Ruth's story are there in the Bible. They are their own agents. Their story, in the words of Marge Piercy, is about how women must wiggle and wobble to live. But how the women claim for themselves God, the divine name and activity among them, is also a key to their survival and their hope. They see God at work, not through the trappings and structures of patriarchy and inheritance and sons and property, but through the divine machinations that challenge and upset those structures, even as they exist within them. It's as if the storyteller is saying to us with a wink, let the men think it's about them. It makes them feel like men. But we know to who the Song of the Women of Bethlehem is directed. It's directed toward that spirit of life that enlivens the courageous hearts of those women who, through their mutual loyalty and devotion, make a world for themselves and their descendants. It is this spirit that's available to all of us who have ears to hear.
Up above my head, I hear music in the air. Up above my head, I hear music in the air. Up above my head, I hear music in the air. I really do believe there's a joy somewhere. Music in the air, all in this room. I hear music in the air, all in this room. I hear music in the air. I really do believe there's a joy somewhere. Up above my head,
up above my head.
I hear music in the air. Up above my head.
Up above my head.
Up above my head.